Today's guest in question is Whitney Webb, investigative journalist Whitney Webb. Whitney has been, if you're not already aware of her, Whitney has been methodically, forensically piecing together the ways that politics and economics and organised crime came together in a hellish, what would you say, ménage à trois that helps explain the mess we're in. If you're not aware of Whitney's work via podcasts and extensive writing, really more to the fact, Substack, published books, then I strongly recommend that you rectify that gap in your knowledge, in your own time, if such a gap exists. Because the story that Whitney tells is, I assure you, more fascinating and compelling and ultimately revealing than any Hollywood thriller you could name. Welcome, Whitney Webb. Many thanks for making time for me.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm frankly in awe of the work that you've been doing. It's your command of detail. And how much of it you seem to just hold in your head at any one time. I'm preoccupied with your ability to articulate a story that's so packed with detail. So I'll get right into it. I think, as I said in the intro, people will have varying levels of awareness of the work that you've been doing. But just to get things off on an even keel, was there an identifiable moment, would you say, when our governments and associated establishments became crime syndicates? Or was it ever thus?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different things you can point to, I suppose, throughout American history. So a lot of my work on this particular topic has been mostly focused on the United States, which is where you can probably tell from my accent where I'm from. But the way, I wrote a book called One Nation Under Blackmail that sort of looks at these origins, and sort of where I pinpointed it sort of goes back, I guess, to the 20s and the 30s, more or less, where this particular group, which called themselves the National Crime Syndicate, this mix of organized crime factions sort of came together. And then during World War II, they formed an alliance with U.S. military intelligence, the Office of Naval Intelligence. And then in the years after World War II, that alliance deepened, including with the creation of the CIA. And that's why you have so much overlap, for example, with early CIA hitmen and people involved in CIA assassinations being members of the mob as well. And that particular National Crime Syndicate was essentially a meeting of the Italian mafia and the Jewish mob being led by Mayor Lansky, and the Italian mafia being led by Lucky or Charles Luciano. And the two of them were childhood friends. And so previous to their team up, organized crime in the United States was sort of an ethnic silo. So you would have like Irish organized crime, Italian organized crime, and so on and so on. It was sort of in these, divided by ethnicity. And these two figures, because of their childhood friendship, sort of came together and sort of broke that pattern. They created an organization that became rather infamous called Murder, Inc. And essentially, through their fusion with with intelligence, became increasingly powerful. And it sort of, they became sort of symbiotic, I've argued. And but really, one of the ways they were able to do that first is they took over the Democratic Party initially, and I definitely argue that they took over both parties relatively quickly. But the way they did so with the Democratic Party, the base of the Democratic Party historically were unions. And so they took over the leadership of the unions and took over the leadership of who counted the votes and all of this very early on in the 20s and the 30s. And, through that, we're able to get their candidates through. And there were a few instances where, they threatened, key people's lives in this sort of political hierarchy in New York State. And then through that, we're able to sort of, move on to dominate the country. And that definitely became very extensive with their team up with intelligence. And it's important to keep in mind that the people that essentially created the CIA and early American intelligence were pretty much all Wall Street bankers and lawyers. People may know about that in the case of, rather infamous CIA directors like Alan Dulles being from the Wall Street law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. But the leader of the OSS, which is sort of the precursor to the CIA, Bill Donovan, was also deeply tied to Wall Street. And even former CIA deputy directors from just 20 years ago have essentially said the CIA has always sort of been bankers. And so, you know, bankers and organized crime, a lot of them are interested in, you know, wealth and ultimately rackets. So if you think of organized crime sort of as its own entity and sort of take away all the associations we have with it because of Hollywood and all of these other narratives, essentially what it exists to do is expand the rackets that are lucrative and perpetuate them infinitely. Because if the racket is discovered or the organized crime syndicate is broken up, the flow of money stops. And so a lot of these lucrative rackets is later, you know, intelligence later became very involved in them. These include things like arms trafficking and drug trafficking. These used to be the rackets of the mob, but by teaming up with intelligence, you know, they were able to expand them and dominate them. And as a result, a lot of the Wall Street banks have become sort of dependent on money laundering. The income they make from money laundering from all of these like illegal rackets has become, you know, really critical to their operations. And people like Catherine Austin Fitz have argued that if, you know, the drug trade were actually to be stopped in any meaningful way, we'd see a collapse of some of the biggest banks in the world. Which is why you have, you know, banks like HSBC, for example, getting caught money laundering for some of the biggest and most criminal Mexican drug cartels. And then people like Mark Carney stepping in to try and smooth things over. Of course, he's a former governor of the Bank of England and Bank of Canada and is slated to follow Justin Trudeau, allegedly, as, you know, head of the left-leaning Canadian, you know, political sphere. So, sorry, went on a little bit of a rant there. I don't know
Is it the case simply that are we dealing with two versions, two sides of the same coin? Is the mindset of the Wall Street banker, is the mindset of the power hungry politician essentially the same as the mindset of the Al Capone and the Meyer Lansky and the Lucky Luciano? Are they all just manifestations of the same character traits?
Yeah, I think it's become increasingly similar with time. And ultimately, a lot of these people have that function like mob families or have documented ties to organized crime. For example, you know, I've done a lot of work on the Jeffrey Epstein case, and his main patron is an American billionaire named Leslie Wexner, who has documented ties to organized crime to the extent that, you know, he's from Columbus, Ohio. The Columbus, Ohio police had put out a report on his ties to organized crime, and it was shut down by the Columbus police chief, who had ties to Wexner and was providing police officers to Wexner's home, like for security and a lot of other corruption there, and essentially covered it up. And those ties came up because his tax lawyer was murdered in broad daylight, shot in the face, and what is considered still an unsolved mystery, even though they did solve it and tied it to Wexner, but they buried their report. And the lawyer was murdered the day before he was going to testify to the IRS about tax evasion, about unspecified things, but he was the lawyer for Wexner's business interests at the Limited. So a lot of these people have spent an insane amount of money rebranding themselves as philanthropists. So I think one figure that was sort of exposed as doing that during the COVID era, of course, is someone like Bill Gates, right? Who has spent a lot of money framing himself as altruistic and as a philanthropist. But a lot of these guys do that. And in reality, you know, this is something from the playbook that was taken from J.D. Rockefeller, the United States' first billionaire, who was very much hated for what he was doing to the country, you know, back in the early 20th century, and tried to rebrand himself as a philanthropist, and did so with the help of people like Edward Bernays, who is considered the father both of propaganda and public relations, which I guess you could argue public relations is essentially propaganda for the corporate sector. But, you know, there's been a lot of manipulations on the public in trying to change our perception of who these people are and what they do. But consistently, these particular networks, a lot of whom are connected to organized crime, have been engaging crisis after crisis that the world has experienced in massive wealth transfers for us to them. And COVID's a great example of that. Where, you know, so many people that seem to have apparent foreknowledge that something drastic was coming were able to benefit so hugely economically, while the rest of us obviously have been left in a very different situation. And it's true if you look at the 2008 financial crisis or any number of other financial crises, you know, that have happened in the past 100 years, you have pretty consistent wealth transfer to the point where like the 0.1% of the world have such an insane amount of wealth and power at this point. And we're still being so manipulated by them to the point where, at least in the United States right now, people are clamoring for competing squads of billionaires to save the country. So, you know, you might have Donald Trump and Elon Musk on one side, and then all the Democratic Party donors, many of whom are from Silicon Valley, like Eric Schmidt and Pierre Omidyar and a lot of these other big names, you know, these oligarch figures, you know, which billionaire faction is going to save us all. But ultimately, at the end of the day, they've been stealing our wealth and convincing us to give away our freedoms in exchange for what they promise is security. But we don't get security. We just get less and less freedom. And we're essentially being herded into what I would argue is sort of a technocratic nightmare, the cornerstone of which is this digital ID agenda, which is meant to be linked to some sort of digital wallet that contains programmable, surveillable money, either a CBDC issued by a central bank or issued by a private bank. And I think ultimately what people need to do is not focus so much on these political saviors being put out in front of us, but focus on what we're going to do to not comply with the digital ID agenda and these other things that they need in order to push us into this world that they've been building. And I would really appreciate it if people would focus on that again, because I think there was a lot of consciousness generated around that during COVID, for example, where people rightly, in my opinion, pointed out that vaccine passports are really sort of a trial run for a lot of this broader digital ID stuff. But, you know, the digital ID stuff is marching full speed ahead. And now in the United States, a lot of the people that were critical of it as vaccine passports are essentially calling for it. I mean, you have people like Trump on the campaign trail saying the U.S. desperately needs a biometric entry-exit system. You have this campaign lawyer going on podcast saying we need to scan our face and our eyeballs in order to be able to vote in the United States. You know, if we need voter ID, why can't we just use a physical ID or something like that? Why does it have to be biometric and digital? And then you see that, you know, the Trump campaign, just like the Democratic Party, are beholden to these Silicon Valley donors. A good example of that would be Trump's recent VP pick, J.D. Vance, who is intimately tied up with Peter Thiel, who created CIA-funded data mining companies that are surveilling Americans and profiling them for intelligence based on our online activity, and are very much invested in these digital ID agendas and digital wallet agendas, and these programmable, surveillable currencies. And again, I think we need to focus more on what we can do as people and as communities, and not think that we can just sit back in our armchair and just vote, you know, once every 4 years or once every, you know, X number of years between election cycles, and everything's going to be magically better. I think people need to take responsibility and think about what we can do as people to opt out of these systems that they're trying to impose on us.
You've already done, Whitney, what mystifies me, what fascinates you, which you've already listed a mind-boggling cast of characters. It's part of what reveals, makes plain the interconnectedness. You know, whoever it was, Einstein or John Muir or whoever, who said that, you know, if you pick up one thing in the universe, you find it's connected to everything else. And your research seems to make plain that whoever you look at is somehow connected to everyone else. And you were talking there about how these competing camps of billionaires, you know, trying to persuade us, you know, which way to jump next.
Right.
I wonder if in your research, if you've come across, is there anyone out there in that, whatever, the billionaire or the influential or the powerful fraternity that's a goodie? Or are they all just degrees of badness?
Well, you know, as far as the, you know, the 0.1% goes, there's a lot of names that are put out in front of us. And then there's a lot of people even wealthier than them that we don't even see. And I think a lot of the billionaires that are put out in front of us, people like the Silicon Valley oligarchs, for sure, were allowed to become billionaires for particular reasons. And some of them, you know, started off creating companies that became huge in Silicon Valley, but they teamed up very early on with the national security state. And then that allowed them to become these monopolies. And you see a lot of CIA involvement in most of these big Silicon Valley companies. And so they were really public-private partnerships, I guess you could say, from the off. And these include Google, which has CIA origins, Oracle, which started as CIA's Project Oracle, that Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison was working on right before he made Oracle the company, and which then became a CIA contractor. You have Palantir, Peter Thiel's company after PayPal, its first funder being the CIA, and then its only client until 2008 was the CIA, and then its engineers made over 200 visits between 2005 and 2009 to CIA headquarters to develop their product. That company, of course, for those living in the UK, now controls all of the NHS data and has since COVID, and it's the same for the United States as well, including efforts to predict the next pandemic before it even happens based on various samples taken from people in these health systems. So, and again, you know, they're contractors for intelligence, you know, the Homeland Security and all of these other security agencies profiling people as subversives. They were the first company used by the United States government to target WikiLeaks. And they had a plan called the WikiLeaks threat they put out pretty early on, I think in 2010 or 2011 or so, and have been going after free speech for a very long time, and targeting Americans for domestic dissent and putting them on the CIA naughty list, I guess you could say, of Americans who could be targeted and have their constitutional rights suspended if certain continuity of government protocols were ever invoked. And these are people that are held up to us as, you know, good billionaires. Peter Thiel, for example, is framed as a libertarian. But if he's a libertarian, why would he build a company that would give the state this kind of power? I mean, it honestly doesn't really make very much sense at all. And, you know, someone like Elon Musk, too, has been framed as sort of a hero. I would argue that's sort of been manufactured. I mean, this is someone who's very open about being a Pentagon contractor, now an intelligence contractor, building spy satellites for U.S. intelligence agencies, and also building brain chips. Which I, you know, just on the face of it, don't really trust that technology at all. And, you know, is trying to make Twitter half of the U.S. financial system and have you link your government issued ID to your social media account and then tie that to your finances, hoping to make, you know, Twitter a major bank and all of this stuff. When you can be, you know, depersoned from Twitter easily, I guess that would mean that when Twitter becomes a bank, you could also be debanked quite easily as well. You know, I think a lot of these people, you know, they have a lot of capital at their disposal. They have a lot of money used to make us think certain things about them, and think they're squabbling. But if you look, you know, like at Peter Thiel, I mentioned, who's, you know, very much aligned with the U.S. Republican Party right now. And then you look at someone like Eric Schmidt, who's essentially been running key aspects of the Biden administration and was a major Clinton donor. They're both steering, members of the steering committee of the Bilderberg Conference, which is an overtly globalist conference closed to the public, where top politicians from around the world, top corporate leaders, and top people from the quote-unquote nonprofit sector come together to decide essentially what's going to happen in the world over the next couple of years. So they seem to agree on a lot more than they don't agree at these globalist confabs, which doesn't just include Bilderberg. It includes things like the World Economic Forum annual meeting or the Allen and Company Sun Valley Conference. I mean, there's infinite number of these that go on, but they seem to be quite cozy, you know, when they're together in these sort of elite conclaves. But for us in the public, they sort of, you know, create, I would argue, a lot of bread and circuses. So maybe there are good billionaires out there, but I think the ones that are pushed out in front of us and that we're sort of being manipulated into seeing as our heroes and saviors, let's just sit back and let Elon Musk save us from tyranny, or things like that. You know, I think that's investing a lot in people who have questionable business relationships, and people seem to get caught up in the rhetoric, whether it's rhetoric about people like Elon Musk or campaign rhetoric when it comes to politicians, and they don't focus on, they don't follow the money, and they don't follow people's policy records when it comes to politicians or their business decisions and business relationships when it comes to, you know, the other type of billionaire.
It's so troubling, the all-encompassing picture that you paint. But do you think there's any degree or any extent to which the looming threat of, as you know, as you were describing it, a digital gulag archipelago, is illusory? You know, clearly, the mood music is to persuade us that once this digital cage closes, there's no escape for anyone forever. But do you think there's any extent to which it's not the case? You talked about the necessity to find other platforms to, you know, to look at other ways of doing things, to turn our backs on some of these preeminent figures. You know, are we being, are we, is there, any way in which we're being tricked into thinking that they have more potential control than they do?
Yeah, I mean, I think they absolutely do. And I think that's part of, you know, the manipulations that target the public or to make us think that we're powerless and we have no power. And these people have invested so much money on finding every excuse they can to try and get us, for in the case of digital ID, get us to voluntarily want to adopt it. And we have to focus on the fact that if digital ID does not succeed and people do not comply, it will fail. I mean, it is the cornerstone of like the entire UN Agenda 2030. Without it, the programmable surveillable money won't work. A lot of their designs for what they want to do in the online virtual world will not work. And so much of it will not work if we do not comply with digital ID, and they're trying to force it on us as a voluntary thing, sort of in the same way that vaccine passports were voluntary, which is why I encourage people, you know, if you want to change the direction the world is going, you need to figure out how you are going to set up your life so you don't have to comply with digital ID the same way, you know, maybe if you were forced to comply with vaccine mandates and vaccine passports, how will you get around those type of restrictions when they try and impose, you know, digital ID on people for various reasons? As I said earlier, you know, before it was about, you know, the vaccine and all of that. Now in the U.S., conservatives mainly are being pitched as this is a solution to illegal migration. This is a solution to voter fraud and all of this stuff. There's efforts to frame biometric digital ID as essential to solving cybercrime and hacking and cyberbullying and any other normal of essentially any ill of society. They're just going to say digital ID is going to be the solution to that. And they're sales pitches. But ultimately, if we, you know, the digital ID is essential to the whole idea of the social credit score and any of these other, you know, Orwellian designs that, you know, at least enough people I hope know by now, is part and parcel of this agenda. And I think, again, it comes up to people having to make a choice. And the way they do this is through, you know, they try and get us to comply with this is through convenience. It's convenience to opt in. It's convenient to have a digital ID. It's convenient to have, you know, money on your phone and have your whole life be based on your smartphone and all of this. It's convenient to vote once every 4 years for one of the two lesser evils in all of this. But really, it's the convenience that they're using to enslave us. And it's inconvenient to find ways to opt out of these systems and change your life so that you're more resilient and your life is actually sustainable for you and your family and your community. It's perhaps inconvenient to get out off of the couch and off of the chair and go meet your neighbors physically and stop being on the online world so much and making real human connections and real human solutions to the problems we're facing. Because, I mean, again, that's why during COVID, the lockdowns, I think, were a big part of it, to keep people isolated, to keep people from connecting and force people to feel like they could only connect with others through this virtual world that these people control, because they control the infrastructure, the software, and the platforms. So I think, you know, people need to consider that this convenience is really the carrot. Maybe there will be a stick at some point, but they seem to be focused a lot on the carrot and the idea of having us voluntarily adopt these things because it's easy the way they're setting things up, or it will be easy. Or they'll frame it that way, at least. But I think it's very important for people to realize that they have the power. Otherwise, they wouldn't be investing all this money to manipulate us and pitch us on this. And, you know, I think it's important for people to think critically about what's being done. And I think, you know, there's a lot of efforts to manipulate prominent voices in alternative media for the purpose of getting people who have realized these agendas during COVID, at least, or maybe before, to come back sort of into the fold and trust certain people that are selling these particular solutions under different metrics. And anyway, again, I think, you know, there is a lot of hope, and a lot of people, you know, listen to my interviews or read my reports and think it's, you know, very black pilling or depressing and whatever. But ultimately, you know, I think it's more depressing to feel like we don't have any power to change things. Only the billionaires do. I think that's a very depressing outlook, personally. And I think these are people we should not be trusting, considering the state of the world and where we are going. And we should take the power back as people. And we do that by taking actions in our own lives and doing things in our neighborhoods and our communities and with our families. And realizing that this is not where we want to go at the end of the day. And there is so much we can do. And I think a good starting point, again, is to say no to digital ID. We don't need this biometric digital ID surveillance state that's going to be used not just to surveil what we're doing in real time, but also to predict what we might do in the future. A lot of these plans on the books and things that are being developed by these intelligence agencies are all about predictive policing, meaning pre-crime, and also applying that same methodology to healthcare. Prevent the next pandemic before it happens and all of this stuff. So you don't even need to declare a pandemic anymore to get emergency youth authorization or mandates in particular communities and stuff like that. That is the world they are setting up. It is very bad, and we should opt out. And we can opt out.
I don't find what you're saying, and none of what I've listened to you saying now and over months and years, I don't find it depressing, because I firmly believe that knowledge is power and that you can't know enough. And so I think that you're simply, laying out often in very condensed and detail rich material, the things that people need to know. And I would also, I wonder, at the moment, it seems to me that things have got especially visible and ridiculous. You know, the whole, sure. the attempted shooting of Donald Trump, followed almost literally moments later by Joe Biden being, erased from the presidential ticket. Other spectacles like Benjamin Netanyahu and the standing ovations that he received in Congress, Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine being invited to sit in on a cabinet meeting for the new Labour government in 10 Downing Street. It feels as though what many people are now calling the Leviathan as a noun to describe the blob or the deep state, that the Leviathan has never been so on the surface, so visible, as it is now. And I wonder at the extent to which, in their final pursuit of digital IDs and CBDCs and 15-minute cities and all of the rest of it, that they aren't actually running scared, and that and to some extent the initiative is with us, so many of us, millions of us, who have seen the Leviathan surface.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think they're being more overt because, I think they're very arrogant. I think they think that they are very confident in their abilities to manipulate people, which they certainly absolutely can. And they can manipulate people very effectively. But ultimately, I think, a lot of their arrogance is their downfall. But it's up to us, once again, to show that they're wrong and show that we're not powerless, that we're not completely dumbed down and egocentric and just focused on hedonistic pursuits, and that we actually care about the state of the world, the future for our children. We're going to say no to these Orwellian systems that are being rolled out globally. I mean, digital ID is something that is being pushed through so fast. The EU is adopting it now for entry-exit stuff. The UK is going to roll it out next year. The US is pushing for it as the only solution to migration and to voter fraud. And Donald Trump is essentially now a shoo-in, and he's been promoting all of these things on the campaign trail. Where I live in Chile is rolling out digital ID, right after Christmas this year. And it's voluntary for now, but all of these things are going to be voluntary at first, and then they'll try and make it so it's, involuntary, essentially. You don't have a smartphone, you don't have the ID, well, you can't come in here. And I think people, again, need to prepare for ultimately what to do about that, and to sort of, maybe it's inconvenient to not have constant access to these platforms and these things at your fingertips, but there's other things, there's alternatives we can build, and we have time to do that now. And I think that's where a lot of the focus should be, and not so much on the circus. But again, I think people too, what's unfortunate now, particularly in like election season, a lot of people that know that it's a uniparty whether in the UK or, you know, the United States, you know, that know that, like, you know, in the UK, the Tories and Labour agree on so much more than they don't when they're actually in power, you know, illegal migration just being one example. And then when you look at the US and the Republicans and the Democrats, pro-surveillance, pro-war, pro any other number of things, pro-Israel, pro-oligarch, essentially, at the end of the day, and nothing really ever gets solved, the problems continue. And maybe, you know, the argument ends up being, well, if we elect this guy, the march towards this tyranny will be slightly slower than if the other guy gets in. I mean, is that really the best we can do? And at this point, you know, people that were aware of the Uniparty getting sucked into this tribalist mindset of I support this guy after instead of this guy and all of that. I mean, I think we need to step back and realize that voting for the lesser of two evils every 4 years is going to end us. We're going to end up in the exact same place as if we just sat back and did literally nothing. And I don't really think that this is the only solution that people should pursue. I mean, I think it's honestly insanity, especially considering what we saw with COVID, where essentially every country in the world adopted the same policies and it made no sense to do so. And now the people that criticized that at the time, despite all of the backlash and all of the name calling, have been proven right. And now, you know, if you're criticizing both of the candidates in the U.S. presidential race, as I am, I'm getting called accused of rooting for the other guy or having Trump derangement syndrome or, you know, being a Trumper also, which I was also called during COVID, even though I was very critical of Trump's first term. And it's just, you know, this tribalist madness. People really need to snap out of it. They're so good at manipulating us and dividing and conquering us. And we need to realize that this is an issue of us versus them, the them being the 0.1% of this global oligarchy that has taken control of both the public and the private sector and have essentially created what my colleague Ian Davis calls the global private public private partnership, which is, again, a lot of people in talking about the World Economic Forum during COVID, you know, painted it as communist. Well, it promotes itself as the main broker of public-private partnerships worldwide, which is, you know, really more in line with what Mussolini defined as corporatism, a fusing of the public sector and the corporate sector, or rather, you know, certain corporate monopolies fusing with the state. And that is essentially what we have. And that's what these public-private partnerships are. And they don't work, but we're being pushed into a even greater deepening of them. And I think there's also efforts right now in a post-COVID era that they're going to do a controlled demolition of certain public sector institutions that they've blamed for everything that's happened, and then take things directly into the hands of these private sector monopolies that essentially control the politicians and the public sector anyway, and is essentially just a bait and switch to get people to think that change is coming, but it's not. And this type of hope and change energy, as I call it, because of the initial Barack Obama campaign in 2008, they try and do this with all these different politicians around the world who are routinely disappointing. They did it, you know, with Javier Milei in Argentina, who, since he's been in power, has been like, yes, I'm going to destroy the Ministry of Education, but I want Facebook to be in charge of the Ministry of Education and Google AI to decide who I fire and who I hire within the government, and outsourcing Argentinian lithium to Israel, saying that he was going to put that he was against the Argentinian establishment, but he's put people that were in a previous very establishment administration, the Macri administration, in his cabinet, including major bankers from JP Morgan in charge of the economy. JP Morgan being one of the banks that helped saddle Argentina as far back as the 1980s with the insane debt problems it has today. It makes absolutely no sense. Based on what his campaign pitch was, and people need to remember that campaign rhetoric, it's sales pitches to get you to voluntarily acquiesce to the leadership of someone who, in the case of a lot of the politicians running in the U.S. now, they've been president before, and they've made it very clear who they serve when they're in office, and we're being led to believe that it'll be different this time. And they did that with liberals in 2012 with Obama. Oh, he just needs four more years. Oh, it was the Republicans. Oh, it was this that prevented him from doing what he was supposed to do his first term. And then his second term was worse. And I think it'll be just the same with Trump, who bent over backwards during the COVID era to this global agenda. He called on Silicon Valley to surveil social media users and profile them for pre-crime, so they could prevent shootings before they happen. You know, that's a conservative president. I mean, that's a horrible policy. When COVID was happening, he essentially outsourced COVID era fiscal policy to BlackRock's Larry Fink, and BlackRock handed out all the money that the Federal Reserve printed. And Larry Fink used to handle, you know, Donald Trump's personal fortune and stuff. You know, it's crony capitalism at the end of the day. And, you know, if you want to think he's different this time, fine, but we can't put all of our faith and all of our eggs in one basket for people that have already shown us who they are. And I think these political saviors are made up, and they try and get energy behind them in all of this. And so many people that know better fall for it routinely. And I think we need to realize the extent to which we're being manipulated. And even if you know that mainstream media lies, that doesn't mean that other people aren't also lying to you or manipulating to you, because a lot of people, even in independent media, have become very beholden to the same algorithms that mainstream media are now beholden to. And the people that control those algorithms are these same Silicon Valley oligarchs who finance both parties and manipulate, you know, essentially control our politicians. And it's important to keep in mind in the United States as well that Silicon Valley has essentially merged with the national security state. They're contractors for the military. They're contractors for intelligence, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, all of these guys. That's what they do. And they manipulate us on their behalf. You know, in 2014, the U.S. Air Force announced a multi-million-dollar research project to use social media to control people like drones, to basically turn people's minds off using social media and manipulate them that way. And militaries around the world, I know it's true in the UK too, with what I believe is, might be wrong, but I think it's like the 77th Brigade or something like that. There's all of these military agencies and security agencies focused on manipulating online opinion. And they've invested millions of dollars in bot armies. And do you think that someone that is a contractor for the Pentagon and for these militaries around the world now through SpaceX is going to say no to those same militaries bot armies that they've developed to manipulate people's opinion on behalf of the so-called deep state that we're all supposed to be targeting and fighting against? I think people really need to take this stuff seriously and realize that, you know, waking up to the illusions around COVID and mainstream media isn't necessarily enough. We need to keep our guard up. We need to think critically and rationally. And we need to question everything, and we need to go straight to the source. That's why I make an effort in all of my articles to extensively hyperlink and source everything I say. Please go engage with that material yourself. Look at the things I researched and the sources I used and draw your own conclusions. Maybe you don't agree with me. But I think, you know, a lot of people that woke up, I guess, from mainstream media have moved to maybe different sources, but their relationship with media is the same. Just listen to what the person says and take their word for it, and don't do any due diligence or research. And I think people need to become, just like we need to take individual responsibility with our lives, we need to take responsibility for the media we consume as well, and become active consumers of media, not just passive media consumers, or we'll just continue to be manipulated in this way and distracted.
Have you found in your extensive efforts to find alternative ways, have you found a channel or channels that you trust? You know, you talked there about the way in which, the algorithms are affecting increasingly the independent journalists, and people are becoming beholden to the same things that have benighted the mainstream media of old. Cryptocurrencies, you know, there's so much heat around whatever a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin and the rest. I hear a lot of people talk about how blockchain, whether it as it manifests in Bitcoin, but blockchain and distributed ledger may have within it the seeds of something that is genuinely free and is genuinely peer to peer. You know, are you confident that in the brave new world that you espouse, that there are already the seeds of channels and mediums of exchange that aren't dirty and tainted and controlled by the usual suspects?
I mean, I think, you know, there was, for example, you bringing up Bitcoin, you know, maybe initially with Bitcoin, there was some promise there. But I think, you know, in a lot of my recent work on this, with the former editor in chief of Bitcoin magazine, Mark Goodwin, you know, we focused a lot on, how in recent years, beginning in 2010, if not earlier, you know, there's been a major effort to capture Bitcoin and the infrastructure and essentially dollarize it, have it become, you know, a tool of U.S. dollar hegemony. And there's a lot of efforts to link it to these U.S. dollar stable coins that are very questionable, whether it's Tether, USDT.
Tethering, yeah.
Yes, or Circle, USDC, which is very much tied to BlackRock. Tether was very much tied to the FTX scandal, and also has a lot of interesting ties to the Epstein crowd as well, if you go far enough back. And... you know, these are sort of being framed as alternatives, but, you know, Tether, for example, recently allowed onto its platform the FBI and the Secret Service to surveil users and decide what wallets they can just shut down at will, and have said that they want to be a key partner of the U.S. in expanding dollar hegemony globally. And, you know, ultimately, Bitcoin was framed as something that's going to stop irresponsible money printing and central bank policy and government fiscal policy. But what's happening right now is that there's efforts to basically use Bitcoin as a sink to hyperinflate into. So basically to make it the greatest enabler ever of that irresponsible central bank policy. And I think, you know, that's part of why, you know, this effort to sort of dominate a lot of the infrastructure around Bitcoin, the on and off ramps, is why you're seeing people like BlackRock's Larry Fink changing his tune on Bitcoin, and allegedly Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan has, and all of these other Wall Street guys, because they think it's something they can use and they can control. And sure, people can use and use it, but the way they're trying to set it up and impose it and develop regulations for it, they're going to try and prevent the use cases where it actually would enable freedom. So for those, you know, that are in the Bitcoin community or developers, now is the time to try and develop solutions that hedge against that. Because again, it's important to be vigilant. In the Bitcoin community, just like so many other, you know, communities in sort of this effort to fight against tyranny, you know, they're being told, just sit back in your armchair, relax, trust the plan, and Bitcoin, because it's so great, will magically solve all of these problems, while, you know, they're basically making it this tool of the dollar and all of that. And that sort of effort to sell people into this complacent mindset is happening across the board. And I think it's something we really, really need to resist. You know, we're being lulled to sleep. And it reminds me a lot of, you know, QAnon in the Trump era, where we just need to sit back and trust the plan, even though Trump is not keeping his campaign promises and doing things that are very against what he campaigned on. You know, we need to hold our politicians to account. We need to hold people in media to account, and really, you know, just be, I don't know, have individual responsibility. I feel like I'm just a broken record with that. But I think it's, I think it's very important. And at this point, you know, even if Bitcoin is co-opted, I think there are things that can be done to use it, sort of invert what they're trying to do to it, and use it to sort of counter aspects of what the elite are doing. For example, there's a, you know, technology that's a part of Bitcoin now that can be used to uncensorably publish you know, documents and distribute it to everyone with a Bitcoin node instantly and have it not be able to be erased. We could make that, you know, use that as a way to really cut out the social media censorship and make it so that important information gets out to people. And there's other things that, you know, I'm focusing on Bitcoin, I guess, but, you know, outside of Bitcoin, there are things we can do, and there are technologies we can develop and plenty of alternatives we can make, whether it's currency or something else. But it's time for people to focus on those alternatives and focus on developing those solutions. You know, why it's still much easier to communicate freely, because I think it's quite likely that as we, you know, go into the next few years, as we get closer to the year 2030, it's going to become harder to communicate online, and people need to, you know, rapidly think about what we're going to do to face this stuff. And a lot of it involves building alternative systems.
To change the subject slightly, when you were talking there about the way in which, you know, people, you know, there seemed to be a coming together, a crystallizing of opposition to tyranny, in the immediate aftermath of COVID, you know, people, you know, seemed to realize that there was, you know, there was something rotten in the state of Denmark. But then people started to sort of snap back into line, be it around Ukraine or whatever. And with that in mind, why do you think it is that everyone, let's say in the US presidential election sphere, takes the same stance always on Israel? You know, there's always this lockstep Israel is only right. Israel is always right. To what extent should we be aware of and worried about the AIPAC Israeli lobby influence, hegemony, really, over American politics?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to say there. And there's a lot of history there as well. So what I mentioned in the beginning about the National Crime Syndicate and the Jewish mob and the Italian mafia getting in bed very early with U.S. intelligence, keep in mind that Israel was created in 1948 when all of that stuff was happening. And the very same Jewish mobsters involved with that in the United States were also sending a lot of weapons to the Haganah, which later morphed into the IDF when Israel was created, and was sort of this paramilitary group that helped create Israel in Palestine. And, you know, a lot of those connections persisted, and you had a lot of early CIA people be very influential in the rise of Israel's national security state. That's why you have like statues in Tel Aviv to CIA officials, early CIA officials like James Jesus Angleton, and things like that. And that's why in a lot of past CIA scandals, Iran-Contra being a good example, you have intimate CIA and Israeli involvement. You know, I would argue that that a lot of those intelligence organized crime-like factions, the United States work very closely in Israel because of that shared history. Ultimately, a lot of the same organized crime networks dominate both countries. And, you know, AIPAC has become a major vessel for that. Again, going back to Leslie Wexner, who I've done a lot of work on, most of AIPAC is populated with people that are former Wexner fellows. You know, he's been very focused on developing young global leaders since the 1980s, and actually directly interfaces, you know, with the World Economic Forum Young Global Leader Program, which is hosted at the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, which Wexner expressly created along with Jeffrey Epstein. So, you know, there's been a lot of influence of these organized crime-linked billionaires on U.S. politics, and they're also very influential in Israel as well. A great example is also the Bronfman family, who, you know, dominated the early liquor industry after American prohibition ended. They're Canadian. They exploited a lot of loopholes. The reason they were able to get their liquor across the border during prohibition is because of their connections to organized crime, which persisted long after prohibition ended. And, you know, for example, the Bronfmans are the people behind Justin Trudeau. Stephen Bronfman was his biggest, arguably the most influential figure in his rise. And you know, the Bronfmans are very influential in the U.S. as well. They've been tied to sex scandals like Nexium. Edgar Bronfman Sr. had a relationship allegedly with Jeffrey Epstein, and as it relates to finances. And that's why Epstein is said to have left Bear Stearns in the early 1980s. You know, there's a lot of these associations that unfortunately you have, an oligarchy that has a lot of influence in the United States and also, in Israel. And unfortunately they conflate criticism of these, people that are essentially the successors, oligarch successors to the Jewish mob, as, you know, representing all Jewish people. And if you criticize them, you're framed as anti-Semitic, but it's actually, I would argue, anti-Semitic to conflate organized crime link billionaires with all Jewish people. I mean, what? And also, like, you know, criticizing the Israeli state or criticizing Mossad is framed as anti-Semitic on occasion. But that's like saying, if you criticize the CIA, you're anti-American, or if you criticize MI5, you're anti-Brit. You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense on its face. And these people are using, you know, what has been historically a targeted ethnicity as a shield for, you know, crimes that they have committed. And that's why I think ultimately none of the real benefactors of the Epstein scandal are ever going to come to justice, and what the client lists and all of that stuff is never going to be made public. And it's because, you know, I mean, we know so much about the Leslie Wexner Epstein relationship, and literally nothing has been done to that man, and nothing will be done. And I think that's a testament to how influential these people have become, and their explicit efforts in dominating, and manipulating specifically, you know, the Jewish community, whether the U.S. and in Israel. Leslie Wexner is a man who bragged to New York Magazine about being demonically possessed. And then he went on to focus most of his quote unquote philanthropy on molding the minds of leaders of the Jewish American community specifically, and also in Israel. And, you know, I think that's, I mean, can you imagine if that happened, like, on the Christian side, a Catholic billionaire that just brags about being demonically possessed going on to train Catholic priests and leaders of, you know, Catholic communities around the world? you know, I think it makes no sense. And unfortunately, you know, the overuse of, you know, anti-Semitism, which does exist, but the overuse of it is being used to protect people who need to be held accountable. And unfortunately, you know, not necessarily saying that all of these people are of one ethnicity, but the fact that these people, these particular actors can be shielded from criticism, the global oligarchy uses them to advance agendas because you can be called a bigot for criticizing them. And I think that unfortunately needs to change. And I think in the US, you know, there's a lot of efforts to compromise our politicians. I wrote an extensive book looking at the use of sex blackmail against American politicians. And again, this is something that the CIA and also Israeli intelligence and really intelligence agencies all over the world learned from the mob, because sex blackmail was something that the mob did back in the 20s and 30s and even before to expand their power and influence. And it's worked very effectively for intelligence agencies since then. But then what I also argue in the book is that in the era of, you know, the technology, you know, after the 2000s, I guess, and, you know, the use of technology and personal electronic devices becoming ubiquitous, they don't really need to compromise us with sex blackmail. They have access to our communications. They can blackmail us with things that they access from our devices, or they can implant things in our devices that are incriminating, even if they're not even ours, and accuse us of things and things like that. And so, you know, there's been efforts to blackmail us for a long time. And, you know, one faction of that certainly is an outgrowth of the Jewish mob, but it's much broader than that. And again, I would encourage people to look at this union of organized crime and intelligence and realize that that's essentially what's running the world at this point. And we don't want these people, including people who are proud of the fact that they think they're demonically possessed, to be guiding where our world is going and creating these systems that they want to onboard everyone onto. I mean, it's complete insanity. And I, again, going back to Silicon Valley, why did every single Silicon Valley oligarch have a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein? You know, why are more questions not asked about that? It's truly mind-boggling. The two Google co-founders were subpoenaed as part of the Jeffrey Epstein JP Morgan case in the Virgin Islands. So was Elon Musk. Peter Thiel had extensive meetings with Jeffrey Epstein. Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn. And these are, you know, some are Republican donors, some are Democrat donors. Why do all these powerful people have all these relationships with a guy that was a sex blackmailer? And I would also argue, you know, a very accomplished financial criminal and currency speculator, which hasn't been a focus of Epstein reporting at all. But these people engage in brazen financial crime and have gotten away with it for a very long time as part of this extensive wealth transfer from us to them. And I'll stop there.
It is interesting that, you know, when you Jeffrey Epstein's name sits, you're right at the center of so many parts of the web. You know, there's so many connections there. It's interesting that there clearly came a time when his use was no more. Yes. It's interesting that even people that are at the heart of these machinations, these Machiavellian figures, they can end up, you know, facing the exit door for all time.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, you know, I've argued before that Jeffrey Epstein was really middle management. The person he was mostly fronting for was Leslie Wexler, who's, again, never going to be held accountable for anything there. And I think, again, you know, he a lot of the Epstein scandal, they want you to focus so much on the salacious aspect, the sex blackmail, the human trafficking aspect. And I don't necessarily want to downplay that either, because it's obviously horrendous and horrible. But I think there's been an effort to have the focus exclusively on that and not on the other things he did, which involve a lot of brazen financial crime that has resulted and helped facilitate this massive wealth transfer for us to them. And I think, you know, some of my reporting on, you know, like when the JP Morgan Epstein case came out, I wrote a piece on Jamie Dimon, and it turns out his rise to power to become head of JP Morgan was intimately influenced by Leslie Wexner himself and, people that are intimately tied up with this group of, you know, organized crime linked billionaires that call themselves the mega group that includes the Bronfmans and Wexner. They co-founded it and a handful of other billionaires that are responsible, for Donald Trump and Barack Obama for their political careers and all of this. I mean, this is something that truly influences both parties. And that's why I think in the United States, unfortunately, so many politicians are completely beholden to Israel and very willing to overlook, you know, the war crimes that Israel commits. And also, you know, the fact that Israel has been a very aggressive nation against the United States when it comes to espionage. Actually, from the Edward Snowden documents, there was one that ranked the most aggressive, espionage countries engaging in aggressive espionage against the United States. And Israel was number three after Russia and China. Why is that? And, documented instances of them stealing, important military technology. I wrote a lot about that as it related to Epstein's visits to the Clinton White House in the 1990s, efforts to directly send sensitive American military technology to China through Israel and all of this. And I would argue that a big part of this, goes back to something that was actually charted out by Samuel Pisar, who was a very close friend of Robert Maxwell, back in the early 70s. He testified before Congress that what was going on in the early 70s was what he called the rise of the trans ideological corporation, where essentially he said Western capital and Eastern capital, so the state-owned companies of then communist Russia and China, were merging with Western capital, and that they were building a system that was making the nation state irrelevant. And he told this to Congress in the 1970s. A congressman asked them if this was a bad thing, and he was like, not necessarily, and this is someone who was very much in bed with both the KGB and the CIA and also Israeli intelligence, and was, one of the closest figures to Robert Maxwell, who helped affect a lot of those things as it relates to technology transfer and other things, why he was alive and his children, the twins, Christine and Isabel, as well as Ghislaine and Kevin and Ian, intimately involved in all that after his death. And this is something that, of course, goes well beyond PSR and just the Maxwells. I think that's ultimately what has been happening. And you essentially have this, I think that helps explain why you have so many of these billionaires in the U.S., including ones that back someone that frames himself as a China hawk like Trump, people like Larry Fink and Steven Schwarzman, big backers of Trump, so intimately tied up with China, for example. There's a lot of these connections of transnational capital. Not enough people follow the money and focus on this rhetoric. They want us focused on it, sort of the more superficial a geopolitical level. But ultimately, these people are all enacting biometric digital ID, programmable surveillable money, whether it's CBDCs or a private sector equivalent, and are all, on board with the Sustainable Development Goals and Agenda 2030, which, if you're familiar with who wrote them and who developed Agenda 2030 and the Sustainable Development Goals, it's people like Mike Bloomberg, a billionaire, and Mark Carney, Goldman Sachs career central banker, also probably a billionaire. It's banker designed. It's a way for, just complete control of the populace, complete financial surveillance, complete surveillance of everything you do. And with the goal, if you listen to people like Yuval Noah Harari, of putting that surveillance inside your body, it's complete madness. And, I would really hope that people,
what you're saying there, just towards the end there, it's so anti-human, anti-human is a mm-hmm. description that many, many people use. The blatant rise or return of a kind of a eugenicist, neo-Malthusian, mm-hmm. Anti-population agenda is so clear. If 2030, if Agenda 2030 is enacted, it will in all likelihood be the premeditated murder of half the population of the planet. And yet it's being pushed in this cold-blooded, premeditated way that I do wonder at the extent to which we have unconsciously, inadvertently created an ecosystem on planet Earth in which thrives and rises to the top a parasitic, psychopathic class that is apart from money and power, is motivated by some kind of fear of fellow humankind and a shared conviction that they would do better if they had to look at many, many fewer of us.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think you know, this eugenics ideology that you point out is making a comeback has its antecedents in a lot of these groups in elite Britain in the early 20th century and also late 19th century and also in the United States. And they sort of came together. But a lot of influential people were members of those. So, for example, you know, the science fiction author H.G. Wells was one of these prominent eugenicists of that era. And he wrote and stated things like, you know, eventually when this eugenic stuff comes to fruition, the human species is going to split and you're going to have the elite who are intelligent, tall and attractive. And then the lower class is going to be these squat like goblins who are intellectually stunted and cognitively incapable of doing what they can do now. And they eat bugs. What do you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems like they've been sort of leading us on this path. And I don't think it's so much that they're anti-human. They're it is anti-human in the sense that they're not anti-human in the sense about when it's applied to themselves and other elites, but people that aren't part of their club, they view as, you know, worse than dirt. And so the idea is to sort of shape people to become what their twisted vision of the lower classes is, to actually become that, like, physically and mentally and emotionally. And we're being manipulated into that, unfortunately. And so this explosion of, efforts to sort of, genetically manipulate us and mentally manipulate us with AI, which is reaching unprecedented levels. And Henry Kissinger and Eric Schmidt say on their book on AI that the end result of AI is going to be the people that are dependent on it for algorithms are going to become cognitively diminished to the point that they can't live without AI. And there will be a splitting of the species, just like H.G. Wells says, into the people who are capable of understanding AI and the people who are not capable. And the people who are capable of understanding it are the people that program and develop AI or who sustain the people that program and maintain it. And then the other lower class, the people that the AI acts upon, who are becoming cognitively diminished and will be unable to understand what AI is doing to them and what is happening to them at all. And this, I mean, it's frankly very disturbing. And a lot of these groups, these eugenics groups never really went away. The earliest days of the World Economic Forum intimately tied up with the Club of Rome, which is an outgrowth of this other group called Adela, that was basically trying to take over, the entire economic landscape of Latin America. All of these Western oligarchs, trying to basically kingmake the oligarchy of Latin America during the mid 20th century, which they did quite successfully. And then they went on to create the Club of Rome. And one of the authors of the flagship paper of the Club of Rome, which was featured very prominently at the early WEF meetings, The Limits to Growth, one of the co-authors of that, a man named Dennis Meadows, is on video saying that if we can't reduce the world population to under a billion people, we must impose a scientific dictatorship that controls 8 billion people. So we either depopulate and you have freedom, or we keep population at the same level, but we impose a scientific dictatorship. I mean, they're very overt about it. And a lot of these groups continue on and are intimately involved in the sustainable development agenda. Groups like the Global Footprint Network, which shares an insane amount of board member overlap with the Club of Rome. And as I wrote in a recent piece with my colleague, Mark Goodwin, who I mentioned earlier, are attempting to impose a carbon market on Latin America right now, built on the Bitcoin blockchain. And they've essentially they're focusing on the local level, the municipal level, not the national government level, getting mayors across the continent to sign over their protected areas to this group, who are going to turn these protected areas into carbon credits. And then have it be traded by all these entities that don't necessarily have these groups' interests at heart and are tied up with the Club of Rome, which is part of this group that, you know, in the 70s, along with Henry Kissinger, framed the population growth of Latin America as a national security threat to Western nations. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. But unfortunately, a lot of the talking points around sustainable development are framed as altruistic. And I think the reason these groups have been so successful is that they frame themselves as philanthropists and altruists, when really they are not. And they do not have our best interests at heart. And so many people are good people, but we have been too trusting, and we are being manipulated now to trust the same people that have been doing this to human society for over 100 years. And if we keep trusting them instead of ourselves and the people we know who are good people in local communities, we are in trouble. We need to stop trusting these people that are being pushed to us and we're being told are our saviors and they're and altruists and all of this. Look at their connections and follow the money, and you will find that is not what these people are, and that is not what these people want. And unfortunately, as far as the transhumanist agenda goes, I mean, that's an effort, you know, I would argue that's because a lot of the people pushing that have really no spirituality at all, and are, you know, as far as the spectrum on material and spiritual, as far to the material side as you can get. And they think they can become gods if they advance this technology enough. And they, but they also, again, have this mentality that they will be gods and the rest of us will be serfs, and it will be the class difference won't be enforced by economics like it once was maybe in the medieval era. It will be enforced by the technology that they've designed to control and that they're making us dependent on. And the more dependent we become on it, and the less we do, and the more we're enslaved by the convenience of it and all of that, the closer we will edge to this world they are building. So it's high time to get less dependent. I'm not saying get off of it entirely if you can't for work or whatever, but it's time to think of alternatives and just even mentally disconnect a little bit. You know, there's things everyone can do.
The cloaking device that is philanthropy is fascinating. You know, I mean, John D. Rockefeller, you mentioned him earlier on, you know, when they took his, when the Anti-Monopolies Commission took his oil company away from him, his baby away from him, and he reacted in all sorts of ways, pushing for the Fed and then, but reinvented himself as a philanthropist, as a cloak. And then you see it manifest obviously in the likes of Gates, you know, who has made more money, he has inflated his personal wealth more since he came out as a philanthropist than at any other point previously. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder at the extent to which Gates, simply by dint of his personality, simply by dint of his seeming utter absence of self-awareness, is just further ahead of the pack in exposing himself as a neo-eugenicist and a neo-Malthusian. You know, he seems blatantly to be declaring his desire for fewer fellow human beings on the planet, and yet still he wears the clothes of and masquerades as a philanthropist. Yes. It's an astonishing sleight of hand.
It is. And, you know, a lot of it is around the very politicized narrative around vaccines. And so, you know, a lot of his philanthropy has been focused on vaccines. But if you look at the philanthropic organizations he's created in that sphere, groups like Gavi, they say on their website, not that their goal is to help improve public health globally. It's to improve globally the health of vaccine markets, in which Gates himself is heavily invested in a number of vaccine companies. And he said, you know, at before COVID, but like at a World Economic Forum annual meeting, he was interviewed by someone and said it's the best return on investment he could have possibly imagined. This isn't philanthropy at all. And I mean, you know, they've tried and gotten away with it by calling some of this philanthropy impact investing. We're investing for impact, but really they're investing in dominating the infrastructure that they're trying to herd us onto to control all of our lives in this new, you know, digital ID centric era. And it's not about helping people at all. And the fact that so many people continually fall for these altruistic masks is very troubling. And someone like Bill Gates too, I mean, you look back, his father used to run Planned Parenthood, which was, you know, sort of the brainchild of someone like Margaret Singer, who was a member of the American Eugenics Society, and very vocal about the fact that her efforts in that sphere were to reduce the population of African Americans in the United States. And then you have stuff going on like the COVID era, where the people that were developing and running the U.S. vaccination program, Operation Warp Speed, wanted to give it all to minorities first, and were framing that as altruistic. These are lesser served communities. We need to be more inclusive and give them the experimental gene therapy first. That hasn't been, you know, even though before COVID, COVID, you know, Moderna's, for example, couldn't even pass animal trials because its mRNA platform was so unsafe and could only be injected into people because of emergency use protocols where all of that testing was conveniently suspended. And then they're going to test it on minorities and frame it as inclusivity and equality and all of this stuff. I mean, we just are suckers for these talking points, and we need to stop and realize that these institutions have been corrupted and they don't have our best interests at heart. But who has our best interests at heart? Our families, our communities, our neighbors. That is what we need to focus on, not so much on these people that are being pushed out as either frontmen for the oligarchs or the oligarchs themselves. Again, going back to someone like Elon Musk, his grandfather helped run the technocracy movement, which is this very scientific dictatorship that the Club of Rome people foretold and people like Patrick Wood have been warning about for so long. Like the Trilateral Commission, which was Rockefeller created, is one of the groups that has been pushing for this so long. And Keir Starmer is a member of that, right? I mean, these people are still everywhere. These agendas continue through these organizations. They're crazy eugenicists that don't give a damn about regular people. So regular people have to give a damn about themselves and stop looking for these people to save them, because they're hurting us into this vision that, you know, H.G. Wells and people like Eric Schmidt and Henry Kissinger have shared, of this idea of there's going to be an upper class and a lower class, and they're going to become different species. And us, the lower class, are going to become basically mentally retarded and eat bugs and become goblins that serve these like super elite that are enhanced genetically and all of this stuff. I mean, it's madness. And we have to keep in mind a lot of the stuff that's being framed as either mental enhancement, like the brain machine interface, or genetic enhancement. All of those things are dual use. You can enhance and you can diminish with all of those technologies. And almost all of those technologies have been heavily developed by groups like DARPA in the Pentagon in the United States and other militaries around the world, specifically for that reason, because not only are they enhancers, they can be used as weapons of war against people, targeting them on the genetic level and all of this. So we are literally, living in a society where maniacs are in the driver's seat, and we need to get out of the car immediately.
I look at some of these, you know, like we're talking about Bill Gates, you know, and you look at him and you think, if you look at yourself in the mirror, Bill, you'd have to wonder if you really are the avatar of the super race. You know, you don't look like you're carrying the ultimate genetic inheritance that really ought to be spread around the world. And it's so true of others of them. They hardly look like ideals. And yet at the same time, as you allude to there, I'm very aware of my kids, my sons, and their contemporaries are actually focusing on things like, and they're aware of real nutrition. You know, mm-hmm. They're paying attention to the things that they put into their bodies, food and drink. They go to the gym, they lift weights because they want to be strong and they want to maximize their physical potential. They look askance at what, you know, my kids describe as the nonsense. I mean, they watch things online, but they seem so attuned to the fact that so much of it is manipulative nonsense. And mm-hmm. I do take great solace from the generation, or some of the generation coming through, is alive to this. They've seen this, and we live in this kind of existential fear of the Bill Gateses and the George Soroses and the Peter Thiels and the rest of these technocrats, oligarchs, billionaires, however you want to describe them. But they've already got their number, and I think you're right. And there are no heroes coming. There's no cavalry coming to rescue us, and nor should there be. You know, that's a zero sum game. But I do think increasingly it's demonstrable that more and more people out there, especially younger people, but not exclusively, are aware that they have to take the responsibility for themselves that you're talking about.
Yes, I think so too. And I think it's important to keep in mind that social media is becoming increasingly controlled. And so for those kind of success stories and seeing those examples of people who are increasingly like that and how many of us there are, you're not going to see that reflected on social media. Social media is very manipulated based on your online activity, what they want you to see and how they want to manipulate you emotionally specifically. That's why Facebook got caught years ago manipulating people's news feeds to make them more depressed and more miserable. They can do that to people, and people that they know see through the bullshit. They want them to feel demoralized. And they do this stuff all the time. And there's a lot of examples of them doing that. Polling, for example, saying that people, 70%, 80% of people hold this viewpoint. They probably don't, but they want you to think the majority do, and they want you to feel alone. And there are a lot more of us than there are of them. And there are a lot of people that know that all of this stuff is bullshit, honestly, and want to do something else. And that all of this technological connectivity is not the answer to happiness and to health, and having like wearables and implants and all of this stuff isn't going to make you healthier. And all of, you know, we need to sort of go back to some of the more traditional ways of things, be more self-sufficient, grow our own food, get rid of the GMOs and all of that stuff. I mean, there's so many examples and there's so much we can do, but what really matters is that, you know, specifically the younger generation, we have to lead by example for them. And we also have to teach them skills that are being lost as people become more and more dependent on technology for our livelihood. If we don't teach the younger generation how to grow food, they may forget. And if it's censored off of the internet, maybe they'll never know unless they're lucky enough to come across a physical copy of a gardening book or something like that. You know, we have to preserve this knowledge. What's interesting too is someone who grew up in the West and who now lives in South America, I feel like there's sort of a generational gap in that loss of knowledge of traditional skills. You know, where I grew up in the United States, no American I knew, except for, you know, much older people like my grandma's age and older, knew how to knit, knew how to sew, knew how to, you know, make shoes or any other number of things. No one really grew their own food. You know, my grandparents, my grandma like worked, you know, back in the 50s and whatnot, and, you know, TV dinners and all of that, you know, they didn't make food and neither did my mom and whatever, you know, all of that knowledge can be lost, whether it's, you know, home ec skills or really anything else about producing what you need, whether it's, you know, fixing a car or fixing plumbing or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. If we want to be self-resilient, we have to build a knowledge base and we have to give that knowledge to the younger generation, because that is how human society has survived. And if we don't want to go back to the literal Stone Age, we have to take care of the younger people and not just, you know, say, okay, watch TV and give them a smartphone because I don't want to spend time with you because I'm sucked into my device too. I mean, that's what so much of parenting, unfortunately, has become. I see it in the U.S. when I go back to visit. I see it where I live in Chile. I mean, it's very unfortunate. We need to, you know, lead by example as much as we can, because a lot of younger people, as you point out, are figuring it out and they're tired of being bathed in all this digital stuff all the time. And they're looking for analogs. Like there's a resurgence of, you know, young people being interested in like vinyl records and stuff, something they can physically touch and own. And we need to encourage that and bring a lot of that stuff back. You know, as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. There's so much to be encouraged by. I mean, within my own four walls, you know, my son collects vinyl LPs and has a record player. My daughter has a film camera and shoots on film. And they found their way to both of those media by themselves. We weren't trying to push it at them. You know, that's mm-hmm. been a natural progression. I live in Stirling, which is a medium-sized town in Scotland. I talk to all sorts of people all the time. Across the demographic, I don't know anybody who wants lab-grown meat. I don't know anyone that speaks up in favour of milk that's derived from maggots, who wants to eat insects, who favours CBDCs over mm-hmm. other means of exchange. I don't know anybody who wants to live in a 15-minute city or who wants a digital ID. So although these things are being dangled over us, sort of Damocles style, there is mm-hmm. no popular support from them, even amongst those that some of us might describe as being asleep or not awake.
Sure.
You know, there's no public uptake of it. And I think that you're right. And the fundamental cause of optimism is that the people I talk to increasingly know that what we're being fed is a diet of bullshit. And we're being led up the garden path by people who do not have our best interests at heart, all the way up to and including World War III. People can see it. And mm-hmm. that's the sources of optimism are in that awareness, without a doubt.
Absolutely. But again, I think, you know, they're going to manipulate the online public squares as much as possible to make you think that's not the case. And that's why it's so important to build a real physical public square with the people you talk to in your town and in your city and in your community and say, what are we going to do about this? How are we we want to get off our knees to these people who are trying to enslave us. How do we do it? It's time to move to that phase of everything. I think enough people are aware of what's going on and that they don't want this. So how do we build a better future? And that has to be done locally, and it has to be done as much as possible in an analog way. Talking to real people, making real human connections. That's the only way we can beat this anti-human future that we're being led into. And again, you know, talking about how your children are into vinyl records and film. I mean, the kind of stuff that the human soul gravitates toward. I mean, we're here to create, and that's what we do. And so instead of like going into the metaverse and being fed an ever-ending, a diet of AI generated slop, let's get out there and like create something new, whether it's art or it's music or it's an alternative financial system. It doesn't matter, but everyone has skills. Everyone has different interests and abilities, and we should come together and build something different. I mean, it's time that we do it. And we're so many of us have been, especially during COVID, have become accustomed to being so online and just having our whole lives be on there and so connected that we really need to disconnect and remember what it's like to be human and create with other humans. And if we don't do that, yeah, we're in deep trouble. But I think, you know, again, I have hope that the younger generation realizes how much of a soulless existence this is and are looking for something real. And we need to join with them, and we need to support that. And again, it's at the local level. It's at the community level. All these people that are going to be put out, you know, on the national stage for president or prime minister or whatever, are controlled and are not going to promote these kind of solutions. They're going to try and stop them, but they can't stop them when enough people at the local level say, we've had enough and we are not going to be on our knees anymore while you're destroying our country and destroying our towns and destroying our world and our environment. Enough is enough. I mean, the same people who claim to be altruistic and want to help the world for public health, but have been stealing our wealth and making us sicker, are claiming that they care about the environment. They want to save the planet, but they're the ones destroying it. This whole world that we're being pushed into requires so much mining, that they want to dig up essentially all of the Andes in Latin America and major swaths of Africa and make them uninhabitable so they can get all the nickel and cobalt and copper to build their electric vehicles and their AI data centers and all of this stuff. AI data centers and all of that also need a ton of water, as do the mines. And they're trying to privatize all of that stuff right now. That's what carbon markets are. It's privatizing carbon-based life, essentially. And they want to do the same with water and air. And the person that came up with carbon credits used to work for the junk bond scandal-ridden bank, Drexel Burnham Lambert, and he invented financial derivatives, which exploded in 2008 and largely caused the 2008 economic crisis. I mean, again, these are like criminal banker schemes, and they're framing it as they're saving the global commons and saving the planet and saving humanity. They're doing the opposite. We need to be the ones that save the planet and save humanity. And we absolutely can do that. We just have to remember who we are, what humans are meant to do, which is create and, you know, lift each other up. And we need to get rid of these people who are keeping us down and destroying our world.
Whitney Webb, you are an inspiration. I could listen
Thank
to you for another hour and a half. I agree. I think ultimately the future's analog and the future's local. But you speak so much wisdom. Whitney Webb, I'll hope to pick up this conversation at another time, take it forward.
Thanks.
But for now, thank you, thank you, thank you.
No, thank you. It was my pleasure.